write out the answers to those nine they told me. And then, when you're done with that, collect all of the answers to question number nine, what should I have done instead, and make a composite paragraph of that, those answers. So I had a dozen answers to question number nine on a dozen pieces of paper, and on yet another piece of paper, I collected all of that material that was in response to question number nine, what should I have done instead, and I made a paragraph out of it. And I went to him. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. My ideal. What should I have done instead? Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. It's our ideal. It's how we really want to be. Not what society says we must be. Not what our mother or the church or whoever said it. But what is my ideal in this relationship? And when I went back to them and I had this down on a piece of paper, I had written out something that looked like this. This was one that I wrote later on. But I kept this one. Be consistently ready to serve her and do so with enthusiasm. This was what should I have done instead as to one of these women. Be a giver. Be accountable. Notice my impact and power and never misuse those things. I'm so worried that I'm out of power, I forget that I have a powerful position in the relationship too, and I was always mindless of that power and constantly misusing it. Be consistently available, committed, honorable, loyal. Loyal in thought, word, and deed. Always make the effort to keep communication open and be a true partner. An answer to some relationship, what should I have done instead? Never manipulate, live in reality and form a relationship with God. Honor her feelings, never obligate her. Look only to God for power and a sense of aliveness. Seek God's will and power daily to be a part of a healthy relationship. Live my life in such a way that God can love her through me. Be aware of the long term and honor it. And that became my ideal for future sex relations. And whatever that ideal is, we have to pray for power to grow toward that. And that was, there was another part of the inventory, the take to the grave stuff. The stuff that doesn't come up as a resentment, doesn't come up as a fear, doesn't come up in the sex inventory. But we need to disclose this stuff to another human being. Maybe there was never a resentment with it. Maybe there was never any, but it was just one of those things that, whether it was a homosexual experience when I was a kid and I had a couple of those, and I wasn't terribly shamed by it so much, but I knew I had to disclose that. I did not want that secret in my life. And there was some money I stole that I had to disclose and this and that. I stole money out of a treasury in that Monday night meeting in Glendale when I first got sober. And it just kind of rattles you when you've done that. You know, it just feels so inappropriate. That went down. Just that little nickel and dime stuff that makes you crazy, you know. $12 and I'm dying over it. And I want to walk through that arch a free man when I'm done with that inventory. And so I had a take to the grave list. That was part of it. And I'm all done with my inventory. And we meet and we are ready for a long talk. And that takes us to five. Step five is, it is important that we pick the right person. It's very important. We have to know that we're picking somebody that really gets it about what we're doing. And it's not hard to find those people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not at all. I guess when this book was written, it was somewhat difficult, and they talk about a clergyman and all of that kind of stuff. But it isn't that so much. Not now. Not now. And usually our sponsor, somebody who's taking us through the steps, is the person that we select. And they know what we're about. And they're honored by our confidence, and they will keep it confident. When I'm with somebody, at the very beginning, we say a prayer and ask for direction and blessing for what we're about to do. We always remind ourselves that it's a disclosure to God, ourselves, and another human being, and we say, God's here. God's here too. God's here. And He blesses this. And there is some stuff to look in the book. It's also interesting that Wilson, finally, after we've done all this work on an inventory, tells us why we've done it. On page 72 at the beginning of Into Action, he says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? And now he tells us why we've done it. He says this, we have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. And an awful lot of this stuff is like, I got smacked good when I was 5 years old, and so I decided to, like a football game, put on a pair of shoulder pads, and I never took them off in case I got smacked again. And nothing fit very well after that. I never took my helmet off. I'm just walking around protecting myself. I got all these reactions, and I got all this stuff that I do. And I have hurt people with it, and I have been inappropriate with it, and I have done all of that stuff. This is all, a lot of it has been simply to protect myself from another jolt, from another terrifying moment. But these are obstacles. When I put on all of that protective gear, it gets in the way. I need to have another attitude toward God. Somebody told me that one way to look at the attitude that they use, that phrase, that word attitude, is as an aeronautical matter. If a pilot in a small plane is coming into the tower, I'll say, what's your attitude? Meaning, what's your relationship with the horizon? Are you climbing, diving, banking left, banking right, climbing out, whatever you're doing? In that sense, I had an attitude toward God where I was leaning away from God. And I have to change it so I'm leaning into God. I'm leaning into. And that's what we want to do. We want to be tucked in with a sense of protection and love and care. But with all that stuff I got to protect myself independent of God, it's an obstacle that's going to get in the way. He also tells us that mostly we lead a double life. We're very much like the actor. To the outer world, we present our stage character. This is the one I want my fellows to see. I want to enjoy a certain reputation, but in my heart, I don't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things I do on my sprees. On my sprees, sober sprees. What'll I do in a temper tantrum? What'll I do when you ever get in a car on the freeway and you're driving down and you're in some imaginary conversation with somebody? And you're going good, you're alone in the car, but man, you're laying the wood to somebody. And then suddenly you come out of the ether and wonder, who saw me? Who watched me pounding on the steering wheel? It's a spree, is what it is. And if there's another human being there who's taken the brunt of it, that has even more significance. The inconsistency is made worse by the things I do on my sprees. Coming to my senses, I'm revolted at certain things I vaguely remember. These memories are a nightmare. I tremble to think someone might have observed me. As fast as I can, I push these memories far inside myself. I hope they'll never see the light of day. I'm under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more sprees. We go down here and read this page 74 and 75. It says, when we decide who's to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory. And they took me to the first sentence in the next paragraph. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And then I started reading what I had written, and we went through it. Went through it pretty slowly, as I recall it. That inventory, had, when I was maybe 24 years sober, it was about it. Day and a half. And he listened very carefully to what I had to say and occasionally would interrupt with a question, occasionally would tell me, all right, go to column 4 and tell me what your dishonesty on this one was. And we went through that inventory. And at the end of it, the end of that second day, I was given the instruction to simply return home and find a place where I could be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what I've done. I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him better. I turned to the page which contains the 12 steps in this book, carefully reading the first five proposals. We ask if we've omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? I was 24 years sober, and for the first time in my sobriety in my life, I knew that I had finally done the first five steps. There was no question I had done that. Never before, but I was through the first five steps, and I had done it completely. The stones were properly in place. I had not skipped on the cement put into the foundation. Here Wilson swings back to those northeastern stone quarry kind of analogies. Have I tried to make mortar without sand and so on? I spent an hour looking at that and thinking and going through that inventory, making notes about where I owed amends, making notes about the fears, making notes about the sex relations. I had a red pen, I think, and I was just putting little notes on it to get it, to be alone with it, to do. And I really did thank God. Oddly enough, for some reason or other, I felt I knew Him better. I really did. I felt like I had left no stone unturned. I mean, like it's like I was signing up for the solution. I finally signed on for the solution that's offered here. And I was very clear that I had done that. And that was a remarkable thing. We go to step six, and for the first time, we're asked to trust our intuitive thought. Because we've asked ourselves some questions here. Is our work solid so far? And then some related questions. At step six, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step six. My satisfaction, for the first time, I'm trusting intuitive thought in this whole process. And step six asks me, are you willing to let go of the traits that you find undesirable, that I find undesirable, that I'm done with? Am I willing to let go of the greed and the fear and the lust and the anger and the rage and the control and the image and all of that stuff? Am I ready? They said, go to the 12 and 12 where it talks about the seven deadly sins and ask yourself if you're ready to get rid of things like sloth. What is sloth? I thought it meant lazy. In the dictionary, it doesn't mean that. Sloth is, in the dictionary, the refusal to accept an opportunity for growth. Am I willing to give that up? Yeah. Is there anything I don't want to give up? Sure. Sure, we're back now to some of these things that are more important to me than a better relationship with God. Am I ready to give up lust, inappropriate sex? Am I ready to give up dishonesty, deceit, all the rest of that stuff? Some I was, some I wasn't. But there's a couple of other, and you don't have to worry about that. You have to tell the truth about it, though. That's critical. There's only three questions here. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things which I have admitted are objectionable? That's question number one. This included old ideas, incidentally. Am I ready to have God remove from me the idea that I cannot trust my mother, that I cannot trust my grandma, that I cannot trust the important women in my life? Am I finally done with that notion that has caused so much trouble in my life? Am I finally done with the idea that there's no way that I can have a decent relationship with a male authority figure, a boss or anybody? Am I finally done with that? Am I finally done with 100 little old ideas? So number one, am I ready to have them removed? Number two, can He now take them all? Will He do that? Then number three, will He do that for me? In other words, number one, am I willing to have them removed? Number two, does He have the power to do that? And number three, will He do it for me? And they had me write number three in here from page 60 of the 12 and 12. Will He do that for me? Just as I am. And the sticky one for me was, does he have the power to do it? Do I have a big enough God that he could remove these things I've held on to for so long if I'm willing to let them go? And I looked at each one of these things, each one of these character defects, each one of these old ideas, each one of these seven deadly sins that I got from my inventory. And some of them I was ready to let go of, and some of them I wasn't. And he said, if you're not willing to let them go, we ask God to take us to that state. And the prayer is, please take me to a place where I'm gladly ready to have you remove this defect. And he does that in a day or two. And we want to make sure we are gladly ready. And we go to step seven. And part of the step seven exercise for me was to do something that replaced the old ideas with what I thought would be more appropriate new ideas. We don't want too many vacuums in there. And here again, I'm approximating what God's will for me would be. Nature abhors a vacuum. In a later inventory, I wrote down these old ideas and these new ideas. Here's my old idea. For me to improve, disaster must be at hand. I don't get off the dime until that fire is real close to my rear end. Here's another old idea. This didn't come out in my first inventory like that, but in a second one, maybe even when I went back to be with Don that time. The genetic pool is defective. I'm flawed. Here's another one. I don't have the time to make changes. They take too long. Here's another. I can't have a mentor. Here's another. I can't have money. Just notions that I've carried all my life that have kind of been submerged and I haven't really been in touch with them, but they come floating up in an inventory. You want to hear the new ideas? Say yes. I'm going to read them anyway. Here's a new idea. The old idea, for me to improve, disaster must be at hand. New idea. To kick it up to the next level is a wonderful privilege, and I do it with reverence and conviction. This is my gift to God. This is my opportunity to rejoice, to celebrate, to say thank you. This I will do as my daily prayer and my destiny again and again and again without end. Amen. Here's the old idea. The genetic pool is defective. I'm flawed. New idea. I'm perfect. The imperfections I've added to protect me are easily allowed to go out of my life. The balance is perfect. Absolutely perfect. No hiding, no secrets, no refusal to communicate. Old idea. I don't have the time to make changes. They take too long. New idea. The time is now. The place is here. Change is easy. Do you get the difference in the tone of this? This didn't come from me, really. It didn't come from my mind. It came someplace else. There's plenty of time. Instant change and shift is the way of God and the universe and of me. Old idea, I can't have a mentor. New idea, I can have all the wisdom, men and women, that I can ever need or want easily in my life. These people are there and will come in. I'll see them and ask. They will offer. They are incredibly valuable. Old idea, I can't have money. New idea, I easily and quickly learn much about money and have great fun accumulating it and handling it with a great and rare wisdom. Now, if God removes those old ideas because I ask him to, and because he has the power to do that, and because he loves me, something that approximates those new ideas will come in, especially when I prayerfully ask for the new idea, when I write it down. Because it's a completely different mind that creates that new idea. That new mind is coming in. That new mind is coming in. And that's the whole point of that drill. And when I get that done, and this is something we have to do carefully and with somebody else, I think, because the new ideas are very difficult to write out because they're beyond my belief system. I believe something much more limiting. And I've got to go out beyond my belief system to even be able to articulate a new idea. Or said a different way, anything that God has in mind for me is much better than anything I have in mind for myself. And I need somebody that really loves me and cares for me and understands this process for me to take that jump out there, leap out there, way out there, amp it up. and start the life I've always wanted to live, because some point along the line I left the life I really wanted to live. I let it go to the side of the road, and I've been living out my second and third choices ever since. And that's my will. Second best, third best. Don't get too grabby. Don't jump. Don't play small. Play small. Don't offend anybody. They won't like you if you don't, you know. And it doesn't, who was it? Nelson Mandela said, it doesn't serve the world for us to play small so other people won't be intimidated. That's not the deal. We got to show up present, fully present in a relationship, in our jobs, in AA, fully present. Let our light shine, because it's there, not just in some of us, in every one of us, every one of us. And here's where we begin to get the new mind. And our old mind doesn't even know it for a while. There's some change in the air, but it doesn't know what. Then suddenly we start acting different. Suddenly people are saying, wow, what's going on with you? And it's an amazing thing. And that's the way it goes. And so that's step 7. And my experience of it was remarkable. Remarkable. And the next time I did it, remarkable. And it gets fine-tuned. And it gets fine-tuned. But we need those. We need a wider, deeper life because of what God wants to bring into our lives. And we scan that inventory for one more thing, and that is for the people we've harmed. We scan that inventory for all of them. And we go to our address book, and we go to our organ, and we go to the group list, and we go to all of these places. This high school yearbook, the college yearbooks, the dental school stuff, if I still have it, this and that and the third thing. Any place there is a list of where I've been participating with other human beings, the Marine Corps, the officer candidate school group I graduated with, all of those people, scan it, because I need to know who's on this list that I have harmed, that I may owe an amends to. And we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about step 8, 9 until 9 o'clock, and then you'll have your meeting. And if you want to, about step 8 and 9, we are at a point when we can go through all of the lists and information that we have and make a list of the people that we've harmed. And there is the prayer has remained, let me see the truth, ever since step 4. And we're still in that prayer. This prayer that I put up here on the wall, the set-aside prayer, was good for the first 3 steps. Let me see the truth. I made a list of people I had harmed. And to jump ahead just a little bit with that list, and at least 4 occasions after I made that list, which I thought was complete, and while I was still in amends, I realized, I saw a guy take a cake at one of the meetings I go to, a guy in AA, and I realized, God, that guy should have been on my amends list. He wasn't on the list. I just realized, I owe that man an amends. I had that same experience with one of the gals in the group. She just showed up one night, and I'm at a meeting, and I said, whew, man, I got to talk to you at the coffee break. And she was very cool about it, but she wasn't on my list. But insofar as possible, we review our past relationships with people and our membership in groups, as I said already, and all of that, and our inventory, of course, extract and make a list of people we've harmed. We make a list of people that we have harmed. And the step says we became willing to make amends to them all. In this age of database managers and all of that stuff, I've heard about making amends by email. I've heard a woman talk the other day that claimed she came out of a blackout in a chat room, for God's sakes. I just report these things. I don't judge. You know.
This seems like a paper and pencil exercise to me, and it, as Joe always liked to say, here's the sound of an amends being made. Can I talk to you? Hello, hi. You may remember me. You do remember. That's right. They told me to get a set of 3x5 cards. After I'd scanned my inventory for the people that I owed an amends to, that I had harmed, and we're talking about people that I've harmed, and sometimes we get a little bit off on that. We think that everybody we resented, we should go to and tell them we resented them. That doesn't really help any. We didn't harm them by resenting them. Sometimes it's tempting to go to somebody and say, I've come to make an amends to you because I've been bad-mouthing you all over AA for the last 6 months. That doesn't help either. I mean, that's not kind. It doesn't... Oh, I'm so glad you gave me that information. Thanks. The amends there is something different. It's to start saying good things about that person to whoever you said bad things to about them. But aside from that kind of thing, and where we've made harm, where we've harmed people and we have a direct amends to make, we have a list of names. They said, get some 3x5 cards, one for each one of those names, and transfer those names to the card. In the upper left-hand corner, put the person's name and phone number, or name and address. Their name would go up here in that 3x5 card. Over here, you would have, down here in the middle, you put the harm that you see that you have done. And in the upper right-hand corner, they told me to put either a plus or a minus. A minus if I was not willing to make the amend, and a plus if I was. And on many of them, I started out with a minus, and as I went through the process, I could turn it into a plus, a positive. Yes, now that I see how this amends thing goes and the freedom and power I get from it, I will make that amends even though I'm scared to death to do that. They had me make these 3x5 cards up, and now I have a stack of 3x5 cards, and the inventory was respectfully disposed of, all of that. And I'm left with the prayer. And whenever I made an amends, I threw the, and so we should have a shrinking list of 3x5 cards, not a whole jumble of unmanageable page after page, and let's see, where was that last? Just 3x5 cards, and you toss the card when you've made the amend so that you know. And the prayer, once I've made the list and gone over it with the guy that took, and so I'm clear on the harm I have done, there are now some things to do. In the format they gave me for making the amends, moving to step 9, here's what I was to do. I was to make an appointment with the person, contact them. If they're in AA, you just say, I'm in step 9 and you're on my list and I need to talk to you. If they're not in AA, I've been going through my life and reviewing my life and some of the problems in it, and I've caused some trouble for people and I've harmed you and I need to clean it up with you, and I would appreciate it if we could meet in person and talk. Usually approached that way, people will say, sure. They said, meet in a public place, but not around a meal. Don't be interrupted, but don't try. Sometimes these amends are very brief, and you don't want a meal going on. You don't want to be interrupted. You can hardly ever get them to pay the check anyway. Yeah, right. Yeah, the pistol range. Yeah, see if you can qualify expert again. Coffee shop is great. A business office seems to work. A private home, not such a good idea. Someplace, a park bench, someplace where you can have the person's attention and you can give it your attention, but where it's not cluttered with a lot of other things. And you ask them, first of all, you thank them for being there, number one. I'm here to clean it up with you, and I really appreciate you meeting me. This is eyeball to eyeball. And the second thing is you tell them the harm as you see it. And the third thing is you ask them if there's any harm that they can think of that you haven't mentioned. And you listen, and sometimes they have a lot to say in response to that question. And the next thing is you say, do you need to tell me how any of that made you feel? And the next thing is you say, what can I do to set this right? And we listen very carefully to that. And I know when Don was here, he spoke to you about how important it is to listen to what they tell you that you can do to set it right and to do that. I know he told you about how his mother said, well, I just want you to be happy. And he took that as marching orders. And we must take these things as marching orders. This is serious stuff. And now he goes by to see his mother every week, and he's happy. He's happy. He lets her know that he's happy because she expressed that wish. Sometimes people say, I just want you to stay in my life. Where did you go? And we must do that. Sometimes people say, there's nothing that you can do. And believe them when they say that. Sorry to believe that. And you let it go. The deal is done. It's a intuitive thing, the timing of an amends. There's a stack of cards. We want to absolutely shift our prayer so that every morning I got on my desk those 3x5 cards, and the prayer is, take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. We don't want to have done all of this work, run out of power, and start over at step one. We do not want to do that. We've got the momentum. We've tapped into the power. We had the power to make the step 8 list. We have asked God if we're willing to make amends, and we take those that we are willing to do, and we start in. Start in with the easy ones. Why not? Start in with somebody I'll see at the meeting tonight. Can I see you after the meeting for just a few minutes? You know, a couple of months ago, I was really rude to you when I said, whatever I said, say it again. Let them know exactly what you're talking about. And they will know. And you know, I don't know how many times I thought, oh, they won't remember that. They remember. Yeah. They remember. They remember. And when you say specifically what they've had on their mind, they know you mean business. They know you're there. And they know you're not. And sometimes a lot of people in AA, no one has ever made amends to them. And of course, no one has ever made amends to most of the people that are not in AA. But it's our absolute opportunity to do that. It's our absolute opportunity to clean it up, to be at peace with our fellow man, to really go to these people. I was married twice when I was drinking and twice after I got sober. And I had relationships all around that and in that and in between. And I'm married now for the fifth time to a lady named Linda, and we've been married coming up 3 years. And so I had a lot of women on my list. And the women that were on my list were women whose dignity I had taken. I brought perfectly wonderful human beings into my life, decided I couldn't trust them because of that old idea, and discarded them and broke the vows of the marriage and broke their hearts and broke promises, took their dignity away. And the enormity of that was very much on my mind when I finally was at this point in the inventory. And I knew I had to clean that up. I knew I had to clean that up. Yes, sir. Yeah, but parents and brothers and sisters want you to be in their lives. Ex-wives, I have not been burdened with an ex-wife. It really hasn't come up, and I think it's a good question, and I think I would have to say one woman did. Betty, I was married to for 8 or 9 years in AA, And she said, "You are not the arrogant son of a bitch I was married to, and what I want you to do is to show me how you got where you are now." And I was single, and for some months we would meet and begin the process of going through the steps. And then she lost interest in it. She really was more interested in getting back with me. And I guess because it wasn't about the steps, she kind of lost interest in that process. And she could see I was all fired up about it, but she didn't want to do it. But she said that, but that's the only one that's ever, that I had been married to that's ever said that. And you're right. I do not want an ex. I don't want to try to be in a relationship with Linda and have something, no matter how innocent it might look, going on with a former girlfriend or lover or wife. That is bad news in a marriage. And there's just no way we can paint that makes it look good to the current lady. No way. They do not go for that. It cannot happen. Boy, you'll see some thin smiles and lots of distance if you start that, I'll tell you. And it's exactly a good point, and it didn't really come up when I was seriously involved with somebody else or involved at all. But it's right. That's a good point. Similarly, we don't, of course, discuss stuff that they know nothing about. That only causes hurt. There's no point in doing that. We also know that they have got some neurons firing that they probably know stuff they don't want to even admit they know. You know what I mean? There's a girlfriend in the picture, and she knows. She knows that. She doesn't know who, she doesn't know when, doesn't know why, doesn't know how involved it is, but they know that something's out. They do. They know that. Women that we've been with, that we've slept with, they have psychic information about us. Boy, they are really, they can thread the needle on that kind of stuff. And for us to go in there and make a half-hearted amend when they do know is nuts. We really have to let them know that we are very open about all of it, have looked at it, are sorry for it. We want to ask them, "Do you need to tell me how any of this made you feel?" And sometimes they really do. And we have to listen. And it's at that time that your mind starts going to what they did. You know. And man, it's like, if I haven't forgiven them for it, I better forgive them. Because that's not my time. So I'm not there. And here's how it goes. Even let's suppose that somebody that we go to, we figure that they're 75% responsible for the problem, and I only own 25% of it. I better figure this. Of the 25% I own, I'm 100% responsible for that. And that's where I got to play this game. That's where I have to be with it. And when we ask them if there's any harm that we haven't mentioned, sometimes they really have a lot to say about that. And again, you listen. And when we ask them, "Is there anything I can do to make this right?" Sometimes it's, "You know you've done it, just come in here." Sometimes I got on the plane. I flew to Roanoke and knelt at my father's grave. I made amends to him. That man terrified me all my life. But I could talk to him from that point of view. From there, I had new power, and I talked to him at his grave, thanked him. You know, when we get to this point, I had always seen my dad as somebody that was never there for me. My dad gave me a lot. He gave me a respect for authority, a respect for the laws of this country, a respect for our nation. He gave me a great deep sense of patriotism, and he gave me a great sense of a work ethic. That guy would get up and go to work when the only thing that could have been keeping him alive was the hope of dying some mornings, you know, because he was a drunk, and he'd get up and go. I couldn't believe he was up and going sometimes, because I knew how drunk he'd been the night before. And he gave me those things, and I had to acknowledge that. We get so focused on the insults and aggravations. Here's my dad. Here's my relationship with him. Here's the night I'm so angry about that he humiliated me in public. Here's the night I'm so angry about he hit my mom. Here's the night I'm so angry about that he slapped me. Here's the night I'm so angry about that he, on and on. And there's 8 or 9 of those things. And when I think of my dad, I think of these things. And all the way along there, we never missed a meal. He's there sending money. When he was overseas, wherever he was, he sent the money. Every day we had food on the table and a roof over our heads because my dad was going to work when he didn't want to go to work. And I had to get in touch with that. The guy is much more than this. But when I'm angry and focused on that, that's all I ever see. I have no appreciation, none, for what happened here. None. And I got to begin to look at it a different way. And I knelt at that grave and I thanked him for those things. And I thanked him for showing me what he showed me about patriotism and about respect for authority and law and about this amazing ability to go to work. And I told him how sorry I was that I had lied to him, that I couldn't get on board the program with him because I was so afraid of him and so much into lying and defending and everything. And I flew to Denver and met with my sister and her husband. I talked a little bit about that earlier. What a shock it was to walk into that home. He had 3 kids, she had 2, and they had 1 between them. So this is like 3 black kids, 2 white kids, and a kid that they had between them. A colorblind home. It was the most amazing thing to see them all loving one another. That kid I told you about that teaches English in high school, do you know where he teaches? Tokyo. He teaches Japanese kids English. I mean, these are gifted contributors. This is a man that fell in love with my sister and married her because he loved her. And she married him because she loved him. And they had done something I'd never done. They had 25 years of marriage at a time in Denver when it was not easy to be involved in an interracial marriage. A lot of pressures. And they stood there and they hung in. And I flew out of Denver with a new hero, I'll tell you that. God, my little sister, that little snot. What an amazing woman she's come out to be. She had her master's. She's doing stuff I couldn't do. And I'm looking down at her. Isn't that crazy? I flew to Portland. I met Carl at the airport in Portland. Made amends to him. I asked him, what do you want me to do to clean this up? He said, stay in my life. Stay in my life. And he asked me, and I said, I want you to... You really want to know what I want you to do? He said, yeah. I said, take the steps. Do this. Do this. But it was a healing, the beginning of a healing between he and I. I went to Seattle where my oldest son is with his wife and 2 children. And I sat with him. I said, I'm so sorry. I wasn't there for you. And his mother divorced me and remarried, and he was raised by a guy he never liked. And he had some tough times and tough ways to go. But he's a good kid. He's really a good kid, and he's a good husband, and he's a good father. And I didn't have anything to do with it. But he's a sweet guy. And I had to clean it up with him and with his wife. Because it splashed on her too. Splashed on her. I had to go to Tacoma where my middle son is with his wife and 2 kids. And the same process. He had an easier time because he really considered his mother's second husband as his father, and he bonded with that guy. Mark was a little too old to do that, but Todd was of an age to be able to do it. But I made amends to him and to his wife. And I went down to Orange County where my youngest son is and made amends to him. He's the one I'm closest to. He's the one after sobriety I paid the child support to every month. He's the one whose mother grabbed him and moved him back to Oregon. And I'm so mad, I'm not going to do anything. And thank God Clancy told me, pay the child support. You may never see him again. Send the check. Send the check. He's a funny guy. You know, sometimes you go to a sponsor and you think you got a problem they're not going to bother you much about. I go to him, I say, I got a problem. He says, what is that? I got like maybe 2 years. He said, I said, my problem is I hate my ex-wife. And I figured, well, what's he going to do with that? But I think I owed him a problem, you know, because he's my sponsor. And so I said, I hate my ex-wife. And he said, you want to do something about that? I thought, uh-oh. I said, sure, I wouldn't have bothered you with it otherwise, right? He said, if you want to change how you feel about somebody, you got to change how you treat them. I said, okay, thanks. See ya. He said, how's the child support going? I said, I'm going to get to that. He said, you're going to get to it immediately, or you're going to get another sponsor. He told me exactly what to do. In those days, I didn't have a checking account, but I could get money orders. He said, you get the money order on payday. You have the envelope there. Don't take it over and give it to her in person. And so I began to do that. And my reward was that 7 or 8 months later, she whisked him out of town in the middle of the night, went to Portland and wrote me a letter and said, you can start sending the money to the P.O. box here at the bottom of this page. Oh, I was furious. Oh, I was furious. I knew Clancy would let me off the hook about that child. He said, no, just send it. Just send it. And I'm so glad I did, because I earned the right to be close to that boy. I didn't see him again till he was 16. And we have a wonderful relationship today. He's really the apple of my eye, but I had to go down and make amends to him for all the uproar in the home. I had to go to his mother was my second wife. I'd gone to my first wife who was up in Seattle. I said, you know, I always loved you. I just couldn't say no to booze. She said, I wondered what happened, because I was always in love with you and I didn't know you were alcoholic. I was in dental school and we were married and her dad was helping us out. And I'm drunk and I'm goofy. And we talked at length one night in her place up in Seattle with her husband in the other room. And we came to peace. And it had been a long time, because I was something like 23 when we divorced, and now I'm 54. I went to the wives and the girlfriends, and I sat down with a guy, the guy that was the one that gave me my first job in the law when I was going to law school, gave me a job as a clerk in his office. And he hired me as a lawyer in that office after I passed the bar. So I worked for him for 4 years altogether. And then he hired somebody else that looked to me like they were brighter and willing to work harder than I was. And I wasn't going to be the apple of his eye and the star and the rising star in the firm. And I got afraid and I left. And he said, you're quitting? Where are you going? And I already had a job and I lied and told him it was about money. And I took off. And I had to go back and visit him. I'd say, John, you gave me an opportunity that was precious to me, an opportunity that few guys in Los Angeles could grab at that time. And I left you, and I left you abruptly and with a lie about the money when I was really afraid that this other guy you'd hired was going to be your favorite and I wasn't going to be your favorite. And I didn't know how to deal with that. And I left you. I was angry and inappropriate, and I'm so sorry. It brought tears to my eyes. He got up from behind his desk and came around and gave me a hug. I said, what can I do to make this right? He said, stay in my life. I said, okay, what would that look like? He said, come have lunch with me. Come every month and have lunch with me. And I began to do that. I didn't have time to do that. From my point of view, you know, Go have lunch. How big a shot are you? Go have lunch. This man wants to have lunch with you. Have lunch. What the hell is that? How busy are you? And I did that. The one thing I wasn't going to do, I wasn't going to go to Billings. There's a cemetery in Billings. I stood at the low rent part of that cemetery when I was 14 years old, and they buried my mother. And I met, you don't love me, I don't love you either. I don't love you. I don't love you. And that dirt's going in there, and I'm not even crying. I just stopped breathing deeply. I don't love you. I can't trust you. I didn't begin to breathe deeply for 2 years when I had the vodka when I was 16. And I always carried that hatred and that anger and that uproar in my heart. Never could trust her. She lied to me. I wandered in that wilderness for 40 years. I was 14 as when I stood at her grave. And now I'm 54. The previous year they'd asked me to come up to Billings to speak, and I didn't have time to go. I'm too busy. Now this year they asked me to speak, the year that I went up, and I'm under new management. Somehow I got time. I did not want to go. I really did not want to go. I'm afraid to go. Walking into that, I remembered Billings as a bleak and ugly and nasty little town. It isn't that at all, but that's how I remembered it. It seems like going back into that graveyard would be like walking into the witch's cave, you know, as my grandma's there. This evil woman, the memory I had of my grandmother was when we were like 13 and my mother discovered that lump, we moved back to Billings. And we lived in the basement of my grandma's place in this cellar. The four kids. And my grandma took my mother upstairs to nurse her. And my mom went in the hospital and came back and went in and came back. And we were not allowed to go upstairs to see my mom. My grandma had her little girl back. And by God, she was going to keep her. And she did not like the kids. And she made it pretty clear. And one day in the spring of 1951, she opened that cellar door and she yelled down there. She said, "Your mother died last night. Are you going to go to school or not?" We went, "Wow. Wow." And I stood at that grave and said, and now I'm back there in that cemetery. 40 years have gone by. 40 years of hanging on to that upset. Having bad relation after bad relationship with women. And I don't want to go back. I really don't want to go back. And there's no getting around it. Not if I'm going to do the deal. And so I said, yes, I'll go to Billings. Seemed like an Al-Anon friend of mine flew up there with me because she was also speaking at this little thing in Billings. And they picked us up at the airport and they took us to lunch. And she, this Al-Anon said, "Are you going out to the cemetery today?" I said, "Yes." "And thanks for asking." She said, "I brought something for you to take out there." And she produced a shopping bag. And I looked in this shopping bag and there's a liter of water in there. And there's some flower seeds in there. And there's some shears in there. And there's some Kleenex in there. And there's some paper towels in there. And she said, "You're going to need this stuff." Oh, I got a guy to drive me out there. And I stomped around in the low rent part. Hard to find a grave marker, you know, if you haven't been there in 40 years. I didn't know where it was. I couldn't have found it the next day, really, after that. And I finally found that little marker, my mother's, Virginia Marie Hodges, the year she was born, this little dash, and the year she died. The dash represents a life.
and her grave was overgrown. When I was a little kid and I got so mad at her and the beating started in our home, she could beat me enough to make me mow the lawn. Where I drew the line in the sand is I won't clip around the sidewalk. That's stupid. She couldn't beat me enough to get me to clean up the job, finish the job. And now I'm back there, and I'm just kind of there. And I don't know what to do. And Clancy told me, write her a letter, and I had a letter. He said, leave it there, bury it there. And so I buried the letter with that little clippers that the Corinne had given me. And I planted some of those seeds there. And I used some of that water and kind of watering those seeds. And I went down the line and visited my grandma's grave, found that grave. And I saluted her and I said, man, you never wavered, not even once. And there's some consistency there I can thank you for, you know. I went back to my mom's grave. And I knelt down there and I started to clip around that marker. And I started to cry. She can't make me clip around that sidewalk. I'm clipping around that marker, cleaning that grave up. And it's all over. It is all over. That simple gesture of doing that. And I wept and I wept. And I told her how sorry I was, because it got to be, you know, when you think your folks haven't done a good job, you think you're the little person that should be the advertisement to the universe that they haven't done it right. Why would I live in a shed when I'm 29 years old? I got to show the world that my mother didn't do it right. You know what my mother wanted for me? She wanted me to be happy. She wanted me to have a good relationship with God. She wanted me to be married. She wanted me to have a family. I can't have that stuff in my life. It might make her happy. Isn't that something? It's like taking a sword and poking it into somebody, but driving it through yourself first. It's nuts. And before she died, I was hell-bent on embarrassing her. I wouldn't do a thing, she said, until she beat me into it. And she was determined to beat me into it. And sometimes she did and sometimes not. But I went to school day after day with big welts on me from that cord from the iron as she would lash it into me. She was angry. And I was making her angrier. So we had an awful time. And I'm kneeling at that grave and I'm clipping around that grave marker and I got it. She always loved me. Day never came I couldn't trust my mom. She worked so hard to be with us. This is a woman that had three kids during the Second World War in Billings, Montana, when nobody knew what was going to happen in the war. With my dad overseas, whether he would even come home. This was a terrified, unsophisticated woman. And I'm giving her a bad time. And she doesn't know what to do with me. And today they'd get a kid into some kind of counseling or something, you know. She would have gone. In those days it was just go to church. Go to the church of the air. And everything was around the religion. She did a superb job. Given all that was going on, she was exemplary. And I was the one that was always causing trouble. And I got it. And I thought I would be done with my tears and I would get up and head back. That guy's over there waiting for me in the car. He'd turn it on and then I'd have to go back. The tears would start and he'd turn it off. I did that four times. He'd turn it on, turn it on. And I'd go back and I'd kneel down. I never wept all my tears until that day. I never have in my life wept all my tears. And that day I wept all my tears, all of them. And I got that I could, that I love, how much I adored my mother. How I adored her.
how it saddened me so much to have lost her, to have pushed her away in that cruel and angry way, to have been such a nasty kid. And I thought I was so put upon. And Carl and I were just known to be trouble. It was a funny thing, when I was about maybe 25 years ago, a guy came up to me at a meeting, a guy named Glenn. He said, "You mentioned Billings. Did you grow up in Billings?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you live over there on Yellowstone Avenue?" I said, "I did." He said, "Were you at Broadwater Grade School?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You don't have a twin brother, do you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "My dad told me to never play with you two guys." My God. And I left that cemetery that day with the whole thing resolved. A miracle of healing. No less than that. There's not enough Prozac, there's not enough psychiatry, there's not enough treatment. It was all in my mind. And I had not only caused her suffering, I had suffered myself, and I had caused a lot of suffering to a lot of women out of those old ideas. And I realized when I left that cemetery that I had more amends to make. I thought of some women whose names were not on the list, women who I had to find and write or visit. And I was totally going to do that. And I did that. We had quite a weekend in Billings that weekend. We talked a lot about that. They took me back out to that cemetery the next day and we drove around Billings. And the following week, I was home again, and Corinne called me, and she said, "There's something that you ought to know about what they're doing in Billings." I said, "What is that?" And she said, "The Al-Anons have taken on a project." I said, "What's the project?" She said, "They've decided as a group that what they want to do is make sure your mother's grave always looks great." And they do that. In the spring, when the snow's off the ground, I get a card and a photo and notes. "I felt closer to my mom being at your mother's grave today." AA's, Al-Anons, go out there. That is a lot of love, you know that? That's a lot of love. And it's mindless stuff in a sense. You know, there's no rational basis for that. It's drive-by stuff. And they were loving me. And I got that. And I go up there and I see these people from Billings around, and it's just an amazing thing. And I came back and I knew that I was going to finish up those amends. And I sat in a meeting one night and a guy took a cake and I realized I owed him an amends. And I asked him for his number and met with him later. This is a big meeting down there, and so you don't see everybody every week. And he came by to take a cake, and they let him take a cake, and he was... And today he and I are close. He and I, he's going through the stuff with me. It's quite amazing. On Saturday and Sunday when I'm in town, in the morning at my office, have guys come over. We don't do a workshop like some of you are doing, but we do... I started a meeting on Thursday night, a stag meeting, where we can sit, the guys that are just doing this, and talk about these remarkable things and these steps. Guys that are 15 and 16 years sober come and say, "Show me what you..." "I'm dying. I'm dying. Been sober for 16 years and I'm dying. Show me." And we sit in this remarkable meeting on Thursday night. Gary sits there with me, 50 of us. Half the time we're bawling about some damn miracle or other, some silly little miracle in our lives. And these guys come over on Saturday morning, Sunday morning in my office, and we go through the deal, and I get a front row seat to the transformative experience in another human's life. These guys go out and do the amends. One of these guys is a J. general contractor, and he's been a remarkable guy, and he's been sober 25 years now. But before he started this process, he had some problems with these jobs. And he had a lot of amends to make, just like I did. And he went out. And he went to every one of these places that had ended in a bad deal. Not just the women, not just the partners, not just the people that we ordinarily have trouble with, but these people. And he knocked on doors and said, you know, when I did that remodel on your house, I didn't do it right. They said, yeah, we know. What can I do to set it right? I'm here to clean that up. You can start by fixing the holes in the roof. How about that? Leaks there. For a year and a half, this man spent about half of his time cleaning that up at no charge. I'm going to do this 120% because I'm late in getting it done. And he did that. He did that. And you can imagine now his business is just thriving. He's a very busy guy and making a very nice living and married to a lady he's crazy about. And he's just like me. Had a lot of marriages, a lot of screwing around, a lot of infidelity. And he's at peace. And his business thrives. Tom is another one of them. Tom was a window washer when he was drinking. Tom is an editor of articles for ABC now. And he's a felon, and he's convicted, and he's gotten that expunged. And this guy still has a bullet in his butt someplace. And he's making a nice living. But Tom meant business about step nine. He was a window washer, but mostly he was a burglar. The window washing job tells you which homes to go back to at night. You know what I'm saying? He'd wash your windows and they'd spot something he needed and he'd come back at night. His territory was South Pasadena. And he had some interesting amends to make. He backed a truck into a bicycle shop through a plate glass window one night and threw a half a dozen bikes in there and drove back out again. And he had to go to the owner of that place. He said, you remember 6 years ago when your glass window was broken and you lost some bikes? He said, yeah, I remember. He said, well, I did that. And I'm here to clean that up. The guy said, you did that? Why are you here? Your parole officer saying, no. I just need to clean it up. I'm on a different path. And I went, why are you here? Why did you come here? And he said, I came here, finally, he said, I'm a member of AA, and I don't want to drink ever again. I don't want to do any more drugs. And I'm really sorry I did that. What can I do to make it right? And the guy was funny. He said, well, don't do that anymore. He said, okay. But what about my guy? He said, the insurance took care of all of that. Are you really the one that did that? He said, I did that. He went back and knocked on doors in South Pasadena. He said, have you lived here for 6 years? Yeah. Did you live here when the home was burglar? Yeah. I did that. And I'm here to clean that up. You did that? Yeah. He had 9 or 10 of those homes. There was one, the last one, he called me up one more. The last amends he had happened to be one of those homes in South Pasadena. And he called me up, he said, I'm going over there today. I knew I'd tried to do it before and nobody was home. I said, this is your last amends on the list? He said, yeah. I said, are you okay? He said, yeah. I said, you want me to go with you? I'll go with you. And he said, no. I said, well, call me when you're done. About 11 o'clock at the office, my phone rang. Tom said, I finished my amends. I said, how did that go? He said, it was an amazing experience. It was just amazing because they invited me in and they had a lot of questions to ask of me about what I had done, what I had taken. I told them what I could remember. And they were an older couple, and they were very curious. And I finally asked them, what can I do to make this right? And they said, you have done it. He said, really? I said, yeah, because you see, until right now, we always thought our son did that. And thanks for telling us. I mean, there's a lot of healing that comes out of that, you know. A lot of healing, a lot of power. A lot of remarkable experiences, just remarkable. One day I was down having lunch with John, the guy that gave me my first job. And it was a time in his life when he kind of wanted to rotate out. And he had made an agreement with another law firm, and they were going to take his attorneys and his files, and he was going to go in as the managing partner of this law firm. And he was supposed to start the next day. And I went and met him for lunch. I said, you must be excited about going over there. He said, I've never had a worse weekend in my life, ever. I said, what happened? He said, they pulled the rug out from under me. I told all my employees I was going over there. I told the owner of the building that we've been in. I ended the lease. I told my clients. I'm going to go over there. And these guys told me they didn't want me. I said, oh my God, John, what are you going to do? He said, I don't have any idea. I said, what do you want? He said, I just want an office and a phone. I said, I got an office and I've got a phone. If you want to, you can hang your hat over there. And he, with another attorney and a bunch of files and three secretaries, were suddenly in my office, bursting at the seams. And I'm like, at honor thy father. You want us to put some decaf in here, John? We'll do that. Yeah, you got it. You want decaf? You got it. We moved to bigger quarters. We didn't have room for all that. I didn't want to expand like that. We moved. You want a bigger office? You got it. New furniture, you got it. What can I do for you? Here, give him honor, give him respect. He's a valuable and remarkable human being, and he's still with me. And this guy got on the phone. He's been in business for 40 years doing the same kind of work I do. He has contacts all over the country, and he decided that he had a little point to prove about these people that didn't want him. And he got on the phone and he started bringing in business. And we are smoking. Man, I can't believe what he can do. He's in there. What do you want of this? Just a little corner of it. Really? And we arrived at a figure and made a contract? Yeah. Little piece of everything he brings in. And I run the office. He brings in the business. He's the rainmaker. His job is to bring it in. Mine is to keep it. Keep the business. Do it right. Give them a dime for their nickel. And I go into his office. You want to have lunch? Let's have lunch. John, I got a problem. I don't know how to handle this file. Tell me what. He's got a mind. Boy, he's got. He said, well, have you thought of that? Oh, my God, I didn't think of that. Do you remember this? He names a case. He remembers these guys. How do you remember all that? He's just got an amazing mind. And he and I are smoking along. Linda runs the office, my wife. She's the administrator, and I love working with her. And we have a staff that's remarkable, and they work hard. And we have a sweet life. We have a sweet life. And we could not have that without this ninth step. I couldn't have any appreciation for the power of this thing, the transformative power. I watched these guys go through this immense, and they go out. Our friend Jim just came back from a tour around the country. He can't talk about it without crying. Relationships get healed. People that he thought hated him love him. And he's on different footing. These amends are not, it takes all the power you can get from the first eight steps to go out there and knock on doors. to go out there and say, can I see you? To go out there and say, I need to clean this up with you. Because we hope it'll go away in a puff of smoke. We don't have any idea the burden that we carry with it. It's there, whether we want to admit it or not. And so, there's a way to finish them, but you got to every day take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it. And that stack of cards begins to go down, and suddenly you're done. And there are some people you can't get a hold of. You write them a letter. There are some graves to kneel at. There's some people that are gone and everybody else is gone, and you write a letter and you burn the letter. You read it to somebody. I'm so sorry for what I did. And one by one they get knocked off. And one day you're done with step nine. And it's really quite a remarkable experience. And I'm glad to be able to tell you about it. Thank you.